Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 108, Snow Scene, Friday, January 29th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Each week, I post photographs and links to things I talk about on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. Today's episode features the following segments: the back porch, the front porch, ever-expanding skill set, and so forth. I'd like to extend a special welcome to some folks who have introduced themselves on the Ravelry board or in a personal message on Ravelry. There's R. Babla, who is Renee from nearby Mountaintop, PA. Vintage Pearl, Lori from Columbus, Ohio, and Jacqueline Salem. Jacqueline, who's from Brooklyn and is host of the Brooklyn Knit Folk videocast. You can find that on YouTube. So welcome everyone, listeners new and familiar. It is good to be back with you after last week's snowy scene. I did record last Friday evening also, and the reason for that was that I anticipated I would not be completely dug out of the snow on Sunday morning, which is my usual recording time. And boy, I'm glad I did, because initially we were not in a blizzard warning here in Delaware Water Gap, but by Saturday morning, the predictions for snow accumulation were much higher. It snowed all day and into the evening, and we had about 18 inches of snow here. It was just a beautiful, lovely, snowy scene, and fortunately, our road department was able to keep up with the snow very effectively. So we didn't have a lot of problems here with power outages or other complications. We did not get very much wind or other blizzard-like conditions except for the snowfall. And now that we have snow, I've been invited on a snowshoeing outing on Sunday morning. So I thought I would take this opportunity to record again on Friday evening and say hello to everyone. The snow interfered with the start of the 2016 sheep to shawl class. So after completing the course as part of a professional development plan last year, I have decided to re-enroll in the sheep to shawl course at Fibercraft Studio in Chestnut Ridge, New York, for another year. And again, yet again, the opening Saturday featured a lot of snow. This time we postponed our meeting earlier in the week when it looked like there would be a lot of snowfall, so no one had to worry about how they were going to make it to the studio. And our first session is tomorrow. So I'm very excited to be returning to Fibercraft Studio and engaging in yet another year of introspection and thinking about craft. Last year, I talked a lot about my experiences on the podcast, and this year, I feel that I would like to dig a little bit deeper into the experience and maybe do some writing about that instead. So I'll certainly mention the highlights and share some photographs, and it would really please me to be able to share some audio recording at some point as well. I'll see how my classmates and the instructors feel about that, but it's something I would like to share with listeners. The back porch. On Friday evening last week, I was anticipating a weekend of very highly productive crafting. And then I ended up being not as productive as I wished. I had also planned to begin a digital detox that would last the entire weekend, and I failed at doing that because I became very interested in the news and what everyone else was doing and looking on Instagrams at people's photos of the snow and chatting with some fellow podcasters and completely lost my resolve. And that distracted me from getting as much done on my knitting projects as I wanted to. However, I did manage to complete my knitting on Flaum. This is a pattern by Justina Lorakowska. It's knit in, it's a cardigan, a cropped cardigan with 3/4 length sleeves that's knit in 1x1 rib and fisherman's rib. I should have given some thought to the fact that in terms of body type, I couldn't be more different from the model who is wearing this garment in the beautiful pictures in the magazine. The model is petite with very narrow shoulders, and I am quite tall with very broad shoulders for my size. And so I think the fashion elements don't translate as well to my figure as they do to this very sleek and glamorous look that the garment has on the model in Imirisu. Nevertheless, this is a very nice cropped cardigan, incredibly warm, and the vertical lines created by the rib are quite flattering. I've worn this cardigan with the front lapel folded back, so it almost forms like a double-breasted look, and I think that makes a more flattering silhouette than just the two edges of the jacket sort of hanging open in the front. I used a little bit less yarn than I anticipated, I think just over 1,000 yards. And when I began this pattern, I seemed to be using up the yarn very quickly, and there were a few anxious days where I was wondering if I would run out of yarn. But I did not, and I didn't shorten anything or go off pattern. I followed everything exactly as written, except that I did not put in the pockets. I had set aside stitches for the pockets and then decided to rip out about a third of the body of the sweater and re-knit it without the pockets. And I am very pleased that I did that. I think the pockets would have added quite a bit more bulk, and they are not functional. They're simply cute and stylish. Maybe you could put a chapstick or a folded up $5 bill in there, and that's about it. So I think I made the right choice with that. And the yarn I used is a merino alpaca blend. It's 70% merino, 30% alpaca in a worsted weight. And I did use the US size 7 needles that were called for in the pattern. Upon finishing the sweater and weaving in the ends, I very dutifully filled a very large basin with water, hot water, and some soak, and put the sweater in to block. It did let off quite a lot of red dye, but it took on so much water that it was very difficult to press that water out. I didn't want to stretch or distort the shape of the sweater in any way, and I didn't want to let it sag or bulge as I was transferring it to lay it out in order to dry. There were several very stressful days when I did not realize that the sweater, when it dried, would return to its original shape, because it just looked like it was going to be about three sizes too big, like the rib was all stretched out. I would never be able to wear it. It looked like an utter and absolute disaster. And I didn't even say anything. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't take a picture because I just felt so horrible about this sweater. And I didn't realize that when it dried completely, it would return to its original shape, which it did, thankfully. But there were a few panicky days in there. And I felt like that was a little bit of a rookie mistake not to understand that. But now I get it. This sweater is one of a make two along project that I wanted to complete by the end of January. And I have. So I've entered the duo into the contest thread of Tiny Paper Foxes. And I really applaud Jenny for planting this seed that thinking about making your clothing and a handmade wardrobe means thinking very carefully about pieces that will work together. And I have been haphazard in my wardrobe making so far. And now I would like to think more consistently about different objects in a color family and how different pieces might coordinate with one another so that I'm really maximizing the potential for these pieces to be part of a wardrobe and not just individual things that I happen to have made. So thank you, Jenny, for that nudge. I hope that it will continue to influence my thinking. And I will talk about the other garment for this make two along in the last segment, and so forth. The front porch. During the month of February, I have a few different projects in mind. Some of them are continuations of things I've already cast on. I am working on my second pair of socks for the year. I'm using some Flying Saucer or Fliegende Untertasse yarn in a very blazing sunspot pink and orange. And for those socks, I'm using a ribbed cuff and leg and a strong heel. And then I'm experimenting with some different toe shapes. So I have completed the first sock and I am almost done with the heel turn on the second sock. So that's pretty exciting. And I definitely like the fit of this sock a little better than the first pair I made over the holidays. But I still think there is some tweaking to do. So I will be eager to continue my experimentation. I'm also working on my hat, cowl, and mitts set. I still have the cowl in progress. The hat is done and I haven't cast on the mitts yet, but I've been looking through a few different patterns on Ravelry and printed some things out, and I think I'm going to use an amalgamation of several different patterns to create these mitts. I would also like to cast on, actually I need to purchase yarn for and cast on for a scarf called The Thistle by Tin Can Knits. And this is just a beautiful scarf, quite long and pretty narrow with a thistle design on half of the scarf and then a pretty simple lace or eyelet design on the other half. And I was thinking of some beautiful lavender yarn because I would like to make several garments in plum or lavender colors. And I think that a scarf like this could extend through several different outfits. I like the thistle theme because I made the purchase of some fabric in a thistle print by Anna Maria Horner. And this fabric is a black ground with vibrant orange thistles printed on it. It's quite dramatic and striking, but I think with the black background, I could almost treat it as a neutral even though it's a pretty flamboyant pattern. And I like orange and purple together. I really don't want an orange scarf. I don't like orange so much around my face. So I think that something lavender would be a nice compliment. And then I'll also be thinking about maybe another pattern for a scarf or a shawl that might coordinate with this fabric and then maybe some other things in my existing wardrobe. Ever-expanding skill set. Last week, I talked about having plans to make potato gnocchi for hashtag Power Pantry. This month, I have been cooking with potatoes all month long and trying some recipes that I've never made before and experimented with different ways of consuming the same ingredient. I did not get around to making potato gnocchi during the snowstorm. I decided on a soup instead, but I may be working on those this coming Sunday. I still have all of the ingredients, so I might still make them during the month of January. I thought that I would talk a little bit about mashed potatoes and any application for mixing potato with other ingredients. When I was growing up, my mother always boiled those potatoes in water and then mashed them. And I really never had a cause to question that method. Also, I never really cared for potatoes all that much, so it really didn't concern me one way or the other. But somewhere along the line, when I began cooking on my own, I read or heard Harold McGee talking about the chemistry of food. And what happens when we mash potatoes is that we break the cell wall in the potato. And if you mess with that structure too much, that's when you get that gluey texture that mashed potatoes can sometimes have. Some people really adore that gluey texture. I am not one of those people. I like a mashed potato to be very light and fluffy. And in order for that to happen, the goal is to remove as much moisture from the potato as it's cooking as you possibly can. So understandably, cooking the potatoes in water completely undermines that objective. Instead, I bake my potatoes for mashed potatoes, also for making gnocchi. I don't boil them, I bake them. And in the oven, much of the moisture is removed. So I just scrub and clean and then give the potato a couple of pricks and bake it in about a 350 to 375 degree oven until a knife inserted into the potato comes out very easily. Then I remove the potatoes from the oven, let them cool a little bit until they're just cool enough to handle. And then I remove as much of the skin from them as I can by hand and use a ricer rather than a potato masher or a whisk. Or some people use an immersion blender or some sort of rotary beater. I do not use any of those things because those kinds of tools are exactly the kind that lead you to work against that cell wall many, many times and encourage that gluey texture. With a ricer, you're working to break up the potato only one time, and then the potato falls softly into the pot. And then any moisture you're introducing is going to be highly flavored and with a very high fat content, like cream or butter, cheese, things that will make your potatoes really rich and flavorful, but no water. which detracts from the taste. So on a separate pot on my stovetop, I usually have some butter and cream, and I really like to use gorgonzola cheese and a little bit of salt and pepper. And after I have put all of the potatoes through the ricer, and when they're still very warm in the pot or the bowl, then I pour over this milk and butter and cheese mixture and work it very quickly and very gently into the potatoes. You don't want to keep stirring and moving them around because that encourages the gluey texture once again. My potatoes always get very high marks from guests who like potatoes, and I find that they are easier to reheat and to use in other applications. For example, after Thanksgiving dinner, one of my favorite things to do is to make a kind of a shepherd's pie with leftovers and put those potatoes on the top. If you'd like additional ideas for using potatoes, I recommend taking a look at the hashtag Power Pantry thread on Ravelry for the month of January, because listeners have posted ideas, links to recipes, and beautiful photographs of their cooking on the thread. Next month, February, we will be cooking with jams and jellies. If you'd like to cook along, you're also welcome to choose an ingredient of your own and share your experiences on the thread. And so forth. I think in a previous episode, I mentioned that I had purchased a book of patterns, Lotta Jansdotter's Everyday Style. I've been making individual pattern purchases. I do like to have a paper pattern. I don't care for printing a PDF file and having to cut and tape it together. So I've been purchasing paper patterns, and they run anywhere from $12 to $18. And when I started investigating this Everyday Style pattern book, there were about 20 different garments and a few accessories for the price of just over $20. And that got me to thinking that maybe this was an avenue for me to take if I wanted to consider more carefully how pieces could go together in a wardrobe. And the whole point of this book, Everyday Style, is to create pieces that work together in a wardrobe. So there's a continuous aesthetic, and there are ideas for how these pieces could work in all four seasons of the year. The styling is excellent. The garments are modeled on women of a very wide range of body types and ages. And also you can tell like their personal style is different and varied. So I really like that aspect of the book. There are three varieties of skirt, four varieties of dress. There are tops, shorts, and pants. There's a jacket that could be cropped or longer. And then there are, I think, four or five different bags. So far, I have sewn the Cecilia bag, which is a sling for a yoga mat. It's very stylish, and I made the whole thing using scraps and leftovers from my fabric stash, rather than buying anything new. And I thought that sewing a bag would be a good test case for seeing how comfortable I felt with the layout of the book and the way the patterns are written. The second garment I have completed is the Esme dress. I chose a tunic length dress with sleeves and a kaftan style neckline. It's modeled on a dress that's much longer, like a summer style dress, but I put the same neckline on a shorter dress. My review of Everyday Style so far is that it's probably a little bit too advanced for a very beginning sewist. You're expected to know quite a bit, and there's not very much hand-holding in the pattern directions. The garments are very simple in structure, and that may seem easy, but it's really important on garments like that that you get the lines of the piece to be very nice and crisp and straight. You can't do too much fussing around. Many of the pieces are shown in very bold geometric prints, and that looks great in the photographs, but that takes a really expert eye and quite a bit of fabric to get that kind of pattern matching to occur. That's a really advanced technique, in my opinion. So it can be a little bit deceptive that you could use these patterns to get that result. As a beginner, you know, the fabric and pattern management that's pretty advanced. These patterns appear on 4 extremely large pieces of paper, a nice quality paper, that are folded up and tucked into the back of the book. I've encountered this with the Heather Ross book, and one advantage to the Heather Ross patterns was that different pieces were printed with different colored ink. So when you looked at this, it looks like just a crazy atlas of lines going everywhere. Your eyes could adjust and you could more quickly pick out the garment you were looking for. And then what you have to do is create your own pattern. So I use a very thin, non-fusible interfacing, and I trace the size that I want and transfer the markings of the pattern so that I can use that over and over again. Or I can use it once and then make adjustments depending on how my first version of the garment comes out, and then keep shaping it and working with it until it's something reliable that I can use again and again. So because all of the patterns are printed in the same ink, it's a little bit disorienting to find what you're looking for. The back pages of the book do contain a pretty nice reference for where a particular pattern is located on those sheets. So it goes garment by garment, and then it will show the pattern pieces, and then that particular pattern you're looking for will be outlined in red in the book. So then you unfold that paper and you can orient yourself to finding the pattern. The pattern directions are relatively clear. There are some instructional drawings, but they are quite small, and there are not instructional drawings or sketches for every step of the pattern, only a few steps. I found the coloring for the right side and wrong side of the garment to be very, very similar and difficult to see. So I would read the directions over to myself several times before completing any of the steps. And that's a technique that I use whenever I can, whenever I'm alone working on my sewing. I tend to read the directions out loud several times before I start to work on that step. And that seems to save me from making silly mistakes, although I can still easily make mistakes. I did figure out the pattern in both cases. The lines of the garments, though, they take a while to master. So I don't feel that my first dress is a brilliant example of the Esme dress. It was not easy. There's some top stitching that I found a little bit challenging. Also, I was working with a very big directional print, and it may be that the print was not centered correctly on the fabric, because I feel like I had it folded Exactly. And then when I look at my dress, even though the hemline is straight, the print the amount of the print at the bottom is not even on the right and the left side. It's not incredibly noticeable, but I know that it's there and it's not straight. So it could be that the print was not centered correctly, or it could be that I just need more practice in preparing my fabric and adjusting my pattern pieces on the fabric before I cut them to make sure that I'm getting a symmetrical cut. I decided to make the Esme dress a little bit smaller than was indicated for my size when I took my measurements and compared them to the ones in the book. It seemed to me that I should be making a size large of this tunic. But I didn't want to make a size large. I wanted a little bit more fitted garment. And so the reason I was fitting into a size large is that the construction for this Esme tunic did not include any kind of a zipper or closure. So it had to be roomy enough that you could get into the garment once you had sewn it closed. I opted to make the medium size, and then I put in an invisible zip on the side just under the left arm. I love the fit of this garment with the side zip. And now I see possibilities that I could even shave off a little bit more along the sides of the pattern pieces, make it even more fitted. And as long as I have that side zip, I should be able to get in and out of it, no problem. I really like the way it fits through my shoulders. I think the sleeves on this dress are eased beautifully into the shoulders of the pattern. I really like the yoke and the facing. It was challenging to do, but I like the look of it, and I like the proportions of the pattern. So I definitely find that the aesthetic I liked when looking through the lookbook section is something that is translating when I actually make the pattern, when I actually sew the garment. And that is really good. It motivates me to keep working from this book. So with over 20 different possible pieces in a pattern book, just over $20, I think it's an excellent value, and I actually want to make almost everything in the book. I probably will not make pants or shorts for myself, although I could change my mind about that. And there's one jacket design that I don't really care for, but I really want to make everything else in the book, all of the bags. There's some accessory ideas, skirts in every length, tops and tunics. I want to make everything else, and I'd like to make several of each piece. So I think that's an incredible value. Once again, that is Everyday Style by Lotta Janstotter. And I have made so far the Cecilia bag and the Esme dress.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. So sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Glenda Kurt sings, but I don't know why. It's a Subway Nature thing. It's a Subway Nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a Subway Nature thing. It's a Subway Nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.